So this afternoon I'd like to reflect on one of the primary qualities that the Buddha described as being essential to an awakened, contemplative, wisely engaged life. And that is the quality, the factor of wise intention. Wise intention. Now, the Buddha did describe this teaching as being radical, as running counter to the ways of the world. In fact, he often described the whole teaching, the whole path, as swimming against the tide. And he described those who followed this path and this teaching of awakening and liberation as being radicals, as being revolutionaries of the heart. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that one way of looking at this path of wakefulness and engagement and all that it asks of us is that it can be seen as a path of radical accountability. I mean, we all know that there is much in life that is lovely and delightful, events, circumstances, experiences, people. We all know that there's so much in life which is not so delightful, which is afflictive, difficult people, difficult circumstances, difficult events, difficult mind, difficult body. But if we really can truly acknowledge that the causes of joy and that the causes of struggle and suffering reside in our own heart, and that the sources of freedom also reside in our own hearts and not in the range of events and people and circumstances of the world, then it follows that to discover really unshakable joy and to discover the end of suffering, we actually need to look deeply into our own hearts. Rather than living in an ongoing relationship with the world and with life, of expectation, disappointment, and blame. That unholy trinity we probably know very well. Expectation, disappointment, and blame. This is the radical accountability, the responsibility. Looking at suffering and joy rather than being intimidated by suffering. And looking into our own hearts and our own minds for what it is that brings struggle, disconnection, disappointment to an end. Now, 2,600 years ago, Siddhartha looked at his own life and he looked at the lives of those around him. And he saw that there was a basic structural problem with a life that involved endlessly running in circles, pursuing objects, things, experiences, attainments that would be able to offer lasting security, fulfillment, and happiness. He saw that this was a basic structural problem. And his advice was to stop running in those circles, to stop imagining, to stop pursuing, and to conceive of a different way of being in the world. A life that was embedded in deep integrity, in equanimity, in wisdom, and in compassion. Now, in this life, in many ways, of course, we are alone. But We are also not independent. We are relational beings. Whether we lived in a Himalayan cave or in the middle of the city, all of us live in a pretty much seamless, interconnected life. One of the metaphors that is used is of the Roman god Janus, who faces simultaneously in two directions. When we look inwardly, we see our personal world, don't we? This is what we see, right? We see the personal world of our views, our temperaments, our moods, our emotions, our memories, our hopes. This is our world of individuality, the world of our self. And we see that that individual world, that world of our self, is rooted in the urgent wish to avoid suffering and to do all that we can to secure our personal well-being and happiness. This is very human. There's nothing amiss with this at all. When we look outwardly, we acknowledge that we live in a very often complex relationship with others, with this world of beings, this world of selves, we might say, whose lives intersect with our own. So our self is meeting this world of many selves, moment to moment in our lives. We are meeting in that world of other selves, their moods, temperaments, personalities, preferences, hopes. And this is the inevitable intersection of our lives, the simple fact of our lives. In a way, we're all tied together. We suffer together, we love together, and in many ways we can only awaken together. Although we can see that our well-being, our happiness, our peace, although its ultimate cause, perhaps its essential cause is within our own hearts, our well-being, our happiness, our safety, our security doesn't exist in isolation. Just as our insecurity, our fears, our mistrust, our anger doesn't exist in isolation, but in relationship. This is the nature of our life engaged in this two-way, ongoing dialogue with the world and with others. We see moment to moment about how our well-being, how our state of mind, our understanding, our moods are impacted upon by the world, how the world around us plays its part in shaping the state of our mind and our views moment to moment. We also see the way that our own attitudes, our views, our opinions, our moves, our moods, our tendencies, they flow out into the world, don't they? Affecting the hearts and lives of others, moment to moment, for better or for worse, with every act, with every thought, with every word, with every choice, we are adding our own little offering to the world around us. Now, this ongoing communication, this ongoing dialogue that we are having with life in every moment, it can be flavored by confusion or by wisdom. It can be rooted in fear or in faith, in greed or in generosity, in harshness or in compassion. We know that we can't actually opt out of the world. And I think our challenge and our invitation is really to quite consciously opt into this inevitable dialogue. It's like Nagarjuna a great Indian saint, when he asked the question, he says, what do you do with a life that doesn't go away? And this practice, the whole essence of this practice, is to stop wanting it to go away. To stop wanting it to go away. In a way, Dharma practice is a cultivation of a way of being in this world where integrity and generosity and compassion are really not just wonderful moments enjoyed on a cushion, or that we stumble across if we're very fortunate. Swimming against the tide means exactly that. It means the kind of commitment that we make in every moment, the commitment that we make in our lives to cultivate all that is wholesome and liberating and transforming. Not only for our own well-being, but also, of course, for the well-being of the world around us and everything and everyone in it. We acknowledge that we can't choose whether or not we engage with this world. We can actually only choose how we are engaging, the nature of our engagement. And it's really why in this teaching such value and such significance is given to wise intention. Some of you more familiar with Buddhist teaching may also know this as wise thought. It's the second link in the Noble Eightfold Path of Awakening. Wise intention. It follows upon the ground of the first link, which is wise view or wise understanding. And our intentions are the vehicles through which we communicate our views to the world. They're the vehicles through which we communicate our views to the world. Our intentions are always drawing upon our view, our understanding. They are embedded saturated with our views. Now, wise intention is the ground of everything that follows. Wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise meditation. All of these are flavored by and preceded by wise intention. It is a pivotal place in this practice to understand. The Buddha put it in the Dhammapada. He said, the thought manifests as the word, or the intention manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit into character. So watch the thought or the intention and its ways with care, and let it spring from love. Born out of concern for all beings, as the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. As we think, so we become. When we see that intention forms this crucial link that connects our hearts, our minds, our view, our belief, with the ways that we engage with the world, then we see that when our intention is wise, so too will our speech, our actions, our practice, our choices be wise. And when our intention is unwise, and this is mostly when it's unconscious, it's like volunteering for suffering. It's just like volunteering for suffering, because we find that confusion of our understanding then permeates our words, our acts, our thoughts, and that's when we end up with a life of regret and guilt. When intention is not wise, which means basically when it's not conscious, what we see instead is impulse. And to really notice the difference between intention and impulse. An impulse is much more that world of kind of blind reactivity. You know, words fly out of our mouths and afterwards we don't only I hadn't said that, you know. You know, acts happen, and afterwards we think, why did I do that? You know, impulse very much has that feeling of being driven, of being governed. It's the world of reactivity. Wise intention is something else. It's taking us into the world of responsiveness rather than reactivity. And this is something really to explore in our life and in our practice and our ways of engaging with the world moment to moment. There is such a tangibly different feel between impulse and reactivity and intention and responsiveness. And one is really the place of mindfulness, and the other is really the place much more of unconsciousness. Now, the Buddha got really, really simple around wise intention, around defining what is wise intention. So it's a really short list to remember. And he said, there's just three wise intentions in this life: renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. It's a very short list. He also got really, really simple around unwise intention or impulse. Again, it's an easy list to remember. Craving, ill will, and harmfulness. Now, for a Buddha, we might say, like, for an enlightened mind, renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion are natural and effortless. They're not second nature, they're first nature. For the rest of us, wise intention is actually a practice. It's a moment-to-moment training and cultivation. But it's acknowledging that every single moment we are cultivating those wise intention of renunciation, kindness and compassion, we are actually loosening the grip. We're loosening the grip of the impulses of clinging, of craving, of ill will. So wise intention, in my understanding, is actually a commitment of our hearts to freedom. And we're practicing them, we're cultivating them, in order to make them into first nature. Now, today I want to look at these three wise intentions, not in the abstracts as something that look like good ideas, maybe in another life, but to look at what these wise intentions actually look like for us as lay people, and to look at what a radical commitment these intentions are and the challenges that they bring. And although I want to look at these three wise intentions somewhat separately, I want to just say that it's important to acknowledge that any distinctions between the three of them is somewhat artificial. It's an artificial separation. Because in reality, renunciation and kindness and compassion are actually intrinsically interwoven. They're bundled together. Just as craving, ill will, and harmfulness are also intrinsically interwoven and bundled together. Cooperating with one another, feeding one another. Now, I think, you know, sometimes people say that these intentions are kind of much more the domain of monastics. But I actually think as lay people in the world, these are actually the intentions that transform our lives. I mean, mostly I don't think it takes a big stretch of imagination for us to see that craving, that the very belief in insufficiency, the belief in insufficiency, the belief in a sense of lack, is actually really an ethical problem for our world. It's not just a personal problem. This is an ethical problem for our world. Because whenever we see that there is this belief in insufficiency, this sense of lack, how much that belief and that sense of lack is a great trigger for the magnification of self and self-view, I want, I must have, I need. All that leads to that kind of tight, grasping, contracted mind, it leads to fear, doesn't it? It leads to a fearful life, a resentful life. And what we do see, of course, that those very kind of mantras of I want and I need and I must have are coexisting with something else, aren't they? I need to get rid of. You know, I have to avoid, I have to annihilate. How the very nature of craving is also the fertile ground for ill will and aversion. They coexist together. And the magnification of ill will, of course, is the ground for unethical thoughts, words, and acts. In many forms, whether it's in the subtle forms of prejudice or emotional violence or the grosser forms of physical violence and greed. Now, equally, I think it's important to see that the intentions of renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion are also cooperating together. They nurture each other and they strengthen each other. Renunciation actually calms craving. You know, that's one of the jobs of letting go. It's one of the jobs of renunciation, is actually to calm craving and to lessen the sense of insufficiency. To open the door, renunciation, although it may not seem like it superficially, renunciation opens the door to contentment and ease and a sense of there being enough in every moment. Renunciation weakens the belief in self and self-view. And renunciation, of course, is deeply embedded in ethics, in the fabric of ethics and kindness to protect rather than harm. Sometimes renunciation is said to be the guardian of the world, as much as it is the guardian of the mind. Now, I want to look at these intentions a little bit individually. Now, first of all, renunciation. Now, this is not a word we use very much. I mean, it's, you know, when I teach in languages, non-English languages, they're trying to translate renunciation. I said, people hardly even use it in English. Never mind in Italian or Spanish or German. It's like this is not part of our day-to-day vocabulary. And we often feel pretty uncomfortable around renunciation and think, what does it have to do with us as lay people? This is what they do in monasteries. I think if there is one single investigation it is important for us to undertake as lay people, it is the understanding, the very deep understanding of what renunciation is. Very deep understanding of it. Now, one of the reasons we don't use this word, renunciation, I'd really, you know, we use other words, but I'd really like you to get comfortable with this word, renunciation. Just to get comfortable with it. I mean, just to say it to yourself and just get a sense of what kind of feelings it evokes. Renunciation. I mean, it's often associated with a kind of coldness. You know, a deprivation, a kind of, you know, transcendence of the world, a sort of disconnection, you know, a cocoon, kind of into the cave kind of life. And we do use other words more easily. You know, we talk about letting go, we talk about release, which are great, fine, wonderful words. But there's something so pointed about this word, renunciation. Now, first of all, it doesn't mean deprivation. You know, to cultivate a renunciate's life is not asking anybody to divorce their spouse, sell their house, you know, send their kids to boarding school, you know, give all their belongings to the local charity shop. It doesn't mean this. Whether we are a monastic or whether we are living in the middle of the world, we equally share in the relentless arising of craving. Whether we equally share in that, it's a dilemma in our lives, and it's a dilemma in the lives of others. It's a dilemma in the life of the world. The relentless arising of craving. This is a story, this is actually by a monastic. It says, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold on to and keep spinning out. I gave up some clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day that the cloth was well woven, so I bought some rags, but I still throw them elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself." "When the mind wants to break its link with one thing, it still holds on to another. Fear says, give me symbols, give me frozen images, give me something to rely on. Love and truth say, only give me this moment." I mean, this is a story of a monastic, but actually, you know, I think everybody here could write their own story of the refinement of craving. I went into a Starbucks yesterday, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't know, but the menu and the orders. I thought, like, somebody would get in their order. It was like a short story. You know, I thought, how can you possibly have a craving around a cup of coffee? You know, that it's going to be this. I was really tempted. I really was so tempted to ask the person behind me at the counter to write me out their most complex coffee order. Because I thought it would make a beautiful Dharma story of craving. And its relentlessness. I would really encourage us, invite us to look at renunciation in a very, very different way. Not as about pushing things away, not about judgment, not about disconnection, but as an investigation and wisdom practice, and as one of the most accessible doorways to the liberated heart. One of the most accessible doorways to the liberated heart. Now, the first level of renunciation does actually have, in a very, very practical sense, something to do with ethics, something to do with how we are in this world. You know, as Gandhi said, you know, there is enough in this world for everyone's need, but there is not enough in this world for everyone's greed. And that is such a simple truth. You know, that there is enough food and medicine, that no one in this world really needs to starve or to die of poverty-related illnesses. And surely one of the great sorrows of our time and our story of being a human being is that thousands of children do die in that way and millions do go hungry. Renunciation is about the renunciation of greed. It's about the renunciation of the belief of insufficiency. Renunciation is actually about the renunciation of discontent and all of the things that discontent does to scar our own lives and to scar the world. It is a commitment to the well-being of the world. And again, you know, greed can feel like as harsh a word as renunciation. But it's actually also a very harsh reality. And it's a very painful reality, insufficiency. I am not enough. I don't have enough. The view of self in that, when it's pervaded by insufficiency, then the view of self is kind of going through the world like an appetite. It's the sort of most idyllic consumer. Huh? the never enough. You know, in the Tibetan tradition, of course, the image, the metaphor that is used is the image of this, of the hungry ghost, you know, these beings who are born with the misfortune of these insatiable appetites and these huge bellies, but this misfortune of having this tiny mouth and very, very skinny, skinny throat, so that no matter how much they consume, they can never actually feel that they're satisfied. And so they're sentenced to this life of roaming the world, of prowling the world in search of that satisfaction, but meeting only disappointment and pain. Now, that metaphor, although it sounds pretty outlandish, the invitation of most Buddhist metaphors is actually to place them in the context of our own lives. Now, this path, I mean, disappointment is no stranger to any of us, I'm sure. You know, thinking something's going to satisfy us, something's going to make us happy, something's going to relieve us, something's going to fill us up. Oh, and disappointment. Disappointment. Well, you know, in this path, we're asked to look at the wisdom of disappointment. Not at the pain of disappointment, but at the wisdom of disappointment. The disappointment is actually the starting point of every great mystical journey. It is the starting point of every great mystical journey. It was certainly the starting point for Siddhartha. He was a disappointed man. You know, he had this life given to him, constructed around him, of endless happiness, distraction, satisfaction, pleasure, protection, image, role, identity. What did he discover? Still a discontented heart. He was disappointed. We can do a lot of things with disappointment. We can turn it into blame. We can turn it into shame. We can turn it into judgment. And we can also actually turn it into a starting point for questioning and investigation to understand the nature of disappointment. Now, renunciation is certainly not about self-denial. You know, self-denial is just another aversion attack, often, even though it looks holier. But I think renunciation is actually a kind of ultimate kindness. But it is asking us to really distinguish the difference between what is wholesome, what is actually need, and what is craving. And when we look at that difference, we see how much craving is actually tied to fear. The fear of discomfort, the fear of injury, the fear of needing to protect ourselves, the fear of being insufficient and being faced with that. Forbearance, I think, you know, one of the lines in the Tibetan teaching talks about the qualities of heart that I needed to travel this path, and it talks about the patience to embrace discomfort. The patience to embrace discomfort in order to see the truth. In order to see what is true. Not to be intimidated by discomfort, but to understand that renunciation, and which is a lot about letting go of that fear of discomfort, is actually part of the fabric of compassion and connectedness. Our discomfort is about as hard for us as renunciation. Because look what happens, you know, whenever we face discomfort in our lives, or even the possibility of discomfort, how it makes us kind of panic and flinch and flee, and how do I get away from this? Renunciation is not about disconnecting from those feelings of panic and anxiety, but having the patience to stay with them. Having the patience to stay with them. You know, all of us, every day in our life, have the opportunities 5 million times to explore renunciation and to explore what it means to stay with something rather than flee from it. You know, if I think back to the years I spent in India and practicing in India, I think probably the biggest teaching and the most wisdom I got from that whole time was rooted in the reality that I almost never got what I wanted. Almost never got what I wanted. And that was so interesting. You know, because, you know, when I look back in that time, the endless strategies I used to try and sort of provide and create this sort of, you know, protected world where I would get what I want, and on a daily basis failing, absolutely failing to control this unpredictable wild life. And there was something about that that was so transforming. But, you know, you don't have to go to India to do that. You know, you don't actually have to go and place yourself in difficult circumstances. How many times do you wake up in the morning and maybe you have a contentious neighbor, you know, or the train is late, or your car doesn't start, you know, or, you know, your milk's gone sour. You know, it's like 5 million things. This is life, isn't it? What do we do? What do we do with that? Do we get into that sort of panic, sort of hysterical, you know, this shouldn't be happening, and then get into that whole cycle of craving or aversion? We just say, actually, here's an opportunity to let go. Here is an opportunity for renunciation. Which is not to say that we never attend to our lives and we never attend to, you know, making our lives work. I'm sure we all do that quite naturally. But those little and big disappointments that we cannot avoid, how do we meet them? How much they spark that sense of, you know, I need to make my world safe in order for me to be safe. I need to make my world predictable in order for me to feel protected. Or how much do we simply renounce, let go of that relentless kind of momentum of trying to strategize every moment to be the caretaker of the world. Renunciation certainly doesn't mean not caring, and it doesn't mean not making wise choices, but it means a commitment to not following the pathways of craving and aversion that always end up in the same place of more craving and aversion. It's a commitment to care, but also a commitment to peace. I mean, certainly I think I do need to mention that there is a shadow side to renunciation, like there is a shadow side to most Dharma qualities. You know, and the shadow side to, and this is why renunciation is always an investigation. But the shadow side to renunciation is to walk away from things and tell ourselves that we're letting go. You know, maybe we find somebody difficult, or maybe we find a situation difficult, or, you know, we're having difficulties in a relationship and we say, well, I'm such a great renunciate, you know, I'm not going to let go of this. I'm never going to speak to you again. You know, I'm going to sort of banish you from my life. This is actually not renunciation. Or, you know, sometimes the shadow side is just turning our backs on something that we find difficult to be with. But that kind of shadow side of renunciation actually doesn't lead to happiness. That's how you know it's a shadow side. It actually doesn't lead to happiness. It actually doesn't end suffering, but only increases it. I think it's also important to understand that you don't shout at yourself to let go. I've always found this to be completely ineffective and futile myself. Let go, let go, let go. It doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work, you know, and it can have that very judgmental tone. I think it is important to understand that I don't actually let go of anything. What I can do, what is possible for us to do, is to cultivate the inner conditions, the wakefulness and the investigation, the understanding in which letting go happens, in which renunciation happens. Not because I'm a terrific renunciate. The understanding that really allows renunciation to come into being is actually really simple. It's about seeing how much suffering is actually tied up with craving and aversion and clinging. It's really just seeing that. And how much happiness and peace is tied up with compassion and kindness and renunciation. It's really that basic. It is really that basic, but that doesn't mean that we get it right away. It's like we have to see this over and over again. Renunciation, as I say, is not a state, it's not a destination. I see it much more as being a wisdom practice. Because we really start to examine how much craving and aversion and clinging are really, really resting in the delusion of projected promise. The delusion of projected promise. The delusion where we believe that this thing, this event, this experience, this person holds some intrinsic power to make us happy or unhappy. This is the delusion of projected promise. Now, it doesn't, I think, take a whole lot of smarts to start unpacking that delusion. You know, this is the story of our individual world. Now, renunciation, I think, mustn't be seen as the kind of blanket condemnation of all desires. In truth, there are many, many wholesome and lovely desires in this life. The desire for peace, the desire for calmness, the desire for justice, the desire for happiness, the desire for compassion, the desire for connectedness, for freedom. All of these are wholesome desires. In Pali, there's two different words. One word is tanha, which means unquenchable thirst or craving. And the other word is chanda, which means much more aspiration. Wholesome aspiration. And it is so important to actually know the distinction between those two. The difference is that tanha never has a good outcome. It's essentially unsuccessful. Unquenchable thirst, craving, is essentially unsuccessful. There's no outcome. Whereas chanda, aspiration, certainly has an outcome. It's not unquenchable. Suzuki Roshi, he once said, renunciation is not getting rid of the things of the world, it's accepting that they pass away. It's accepting that we pass away, that they pass away, and that actually we pass away too. Can we accept that? The wonderful and the terrible events, every thought, every sensation, the people we love and those that we hate, every emotion, every mood, everything that happens in the body, and in fact the body itself, will pass away in time. And if we could accept that, think how much easier renunciation is. Just think how much easier renunciation would be. If we can accept that the things of the world pass away, just imagine how much agitation and fear and tension would also pass away. Because so much of the tension, the fear and the agitation is actually about trying either to make things pass away faster or to make them last longer. Renunciation, I think, is in truth the practice of happiness, the practice of freedom. But it is a practice. You know, most of us have a much longer history and more experience with craving and clinging than we do with letting go. One of the parts of the practice of renunciation is the practice of restraint. again, which is countercultural because restraint is often equated with suppression. Again, restraint's not hardly a very popular cultural pastime, is it? Restraint is about being mindful at our sense doors. Mindful at our sense doors, our eyes, our ears, our mouths, all that flow in and all that flow out. This is a practice. Restraint is a practice not just for our cushion. Restraint is truly a practice for our life. Some of you who are familiar with Buddhist teaching more will be familiar with this wheel of life, which talks about how our world, our personal world, is constructed moment to moment. And in that wheel of life, the sense doors, our eyes, ears, body, mind, nose, tongue, they're portrayed or pictured as being the open windows in a house. Now, through those windows of our sense doors, the world flows in. We have all the sights, the sounds, the tastes, the touch, the smells. But also, the world flows out through those windows. The world of our likes, dislikes, moods, preferences, they're all flowing out through the sense doors. So too does compassion, kindness, care, empathy, generosity, all flow out through the sense doors. It's like Walt Whitman once said, you know, everything we have ever done, everything we do, and everything we will ever do, we will do in this body. And we will do through this body. So mindfulness is encouraging us to be mindful at these sense doors. As the Buddha, to learn to cultivate a pregnant pause, that's what restraint is. To learn to cultivate a pregnant pause before the outflows from our sense doors. Before our thoughts, our words, our acts move through the sense doors, can we have that pregnant pause to know, does this spring from love? Does this spring from wise intention? Or does this spring from impulse and from blindness? The Buddha once said that there is nothing that can cause so much harm as a thought unguarded. Nothing that can cause so much harm as a thought unguarded. And that means a thought that is not guarded by mindfulness, that does not spring from love. He also said nothing can be of so much benefit as a thought that is born of mindfulness and love. You know, in the Sufi tradition, it's often said that before we speak, before we act, before we are moved by our thoughts, that our thoughts should pass through three gates. And at the first gate, we should ask of our thoughts, is this helpful? Is this necessary? And if that's so, to let the thought pass through that through that gate. The second gate we ask of that thought, is it true? If so, the thought passes through the gate. And at the third gate we ask, is this kind? Excuse me. And if so, the thought passes through that gate. Lastly, I'd like you just to invite you to reflect upon the benefits, the fruits of renunciation. Because actually we don't do this to punish ourselves. But every moment of letting go of craving and aversion really does lessen the mountain of suffering in the world. The fruit of renunciation is a spacious, unbounded heart. It's a natural loving kindness and compassion. It's a tremendous sense of inner freedom, of not being governed by anything. And above all, renunciation really does allow the arising of loving kindness and compassion. Allows the natural arising of loving kindness and compassion. Now, loving kindness is a very special form of renunciation because it is the renunciation of ill will. And for many people, this is the most challenging of all renunciations. We see how the sense of injury and the fear of injury lurks within us so often, casting us into modes of defense and attack. The places where we see the creation of self and other most strongly is in ill will. And loving kindness is truly dedicated to the healing of ill will. In the Tibetan tradition, it said, used wisely, this body, this mind is a raft to freedom. Used unwisely, this body, this mind ties us to suffering. This body, this mind does the bidding of the skillful and the unskillful, the wholesome and the unwholesome. Now again, the renunciation of ill will, loving kindness, doesn't happen because we think we should be more loving. It happens only in the light of wisdom. Now, as lay people, you know, we interact with a vast range of people and events that ask for our response. Now, some of those people and events are truly difficult. This is not all in the mind. Some are lovely. Some are wonderful. We meet people who contribute tremendous generosity to the world, and we meet those who harm. But we are asked, actually, to relate to them all. We are asked to explore the possibility of bringing a very heartfelt sense of warmth and friendliness and kindness unconditionally to this whole world of relatedness. We don't always know the effect of our acts or our words upon others. But we can perhaps have some assurance about whether our words and acts do truly spring from love, do truly spring from kindness. Renunciation is actually the forerunner of loving kindness, and loving kindness is the forerunner of compassion. It's the third wise intention. Just as compassion also fosters loving-kindness and renunciation. Now, I think suffering is a very real, harsh, tormented reality in this world, whether it is the visible sufferings of war and hunger or the sufferings of loneliness, deprivation, fear. It's the first noble truth. It's the first noble truth. That there is unsatisfactoriness in this life. And within that first noble truth, we're asked to find the heart that can respond with compassion. That doesn't flee. Now sometimes compassion is something we experience arising so naturally and so spontaneously. You know, we're faced with someone in terrible suffering or difficulty, and you can feel the heart soften. And the sense of the barriers between self and other just seem to naturally fall away. And you can feel that very natural, profound sense of empathy, connectedness, warmth. And yet many times that also doesn't happen in the face of suffering. And this practice and this path is about not leaving those moments of opening, those moments of compassion to accidents. But as a way of being in this world, a fabric of our own hearts and consciousness that is cultivated. Part of it is learning to pause again and again, to listen so deeply in this life. You know, when you see the person sleeping in the doorway. I mean, I was amazed when I came out early this morning of my hotel. You know, and there was a whole other world on the streets. You know, not just one or two, it was like a whole army of people sleeping in doorways, you know. I thought, you know, just to pause in those moments, to pause in the face of distress, to pause in the obvious and more subtle faces of suffering, and to listen without blame, to listen without story. The Buddha said it so, so simply, to know suffering as suffering. And what does it ask? What does it ask? Sometimes it has, it's not just one thing that is asked for. If you look at the kind of statue of Kuan Yin, which is how we often see compassion embodied in this tradition, Kuan Yin is often portrayed as this receptive, open figure. But if you look at the history of Kuan Yin was often portrayed as a sort of armed warrior, you know, who went out into the world, who had that capacity for empathy and to listen, but also the courage and fearlessness to say no to the causes of suffering. To say no to the causes of suffering. But for compassion, I think, to really come into maturity in our life, it asks for renunciation. It asks for the renunciation of self and other, of fear and ill will. It asks for kindness. And then our hearts can soften, can tremble, as they say in this teaching. The heart that can tremble in the face of suffering. We cultivate, I think, in this practice, the garden. We cultivate the garden of wise intention. Moment to moment, on our cushions, off the cushions, renunciation, kindness, compassion, to just have a sense of what do these really mean in our lives and what difference do they make, not only for our own well-being, but for the well-being of all beings.